Hey, welcome to the Socialist Shelf. And we are really excited today to have an interview with a man that I know a lot of our listenership has already read, definitely read a lot of his books, listened to some of his interviews. We have Vijay Prashad. He's executive director of the Tricontinental Institute, prolific writer, written books such as Washington Bullets, recently wrote The Withdrawal, Iraq, Libya, Afghanistan, and the Fragility of U.S. Power. How are you doing today, Vijay?
What a day. What a day.
Yeah.
I just came to you after recording a show with Brian Becker of the Socialist Program.
Oh, yeah.
Brilliant.
Talking about, the New York Times and so on. That was fun. Mm. Basically, I spend my day reading, writing, and making a mess of things. So here it is. You know, here we are together.
Something for us all to aspire to. Yeah, absolutely.
I suppose, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, we love this. We both love the Socialist Program on here. Highly recommend anybody who's listening to that. If you want to get some news, you want to get some more serious analysis, not just talking about media and stuff. If you want to go that direction, go definitely check that out. But we appreciate having you on our show. Have you seen any good movies recently? Read any good books? What is your, how's that been? What have you been into?
Okay, let's just go straight to it then, shall we?
Go straight to it. Yeah.
I saw the Flash movie. And okay. I don't know what people think of movies like that, but I found it really, really interesting.
Okay.
For several reasons, you know. You see, one of the interesting things with fiction is it allows you to think about, you know, the possibilities in history, things that could have happened or might happen in the future. In a way, it allows you to stretch your imagination, you know. If you could do that, how would you deal with it? What are the ethics of behavior? You know, what are the limits? Well, what's interesting about this film, it's about a young boy, really, whose mother is killed and his father is blamed for the murder and his father is in prison. And he grows up without his mother, whom he loved, and with the belief that his father didn't commit the crime of killing the mother. Mm. So, you know, he discovers accidentally that he has all these powers because he gets hit by lightning. And they're extraordinary powers. Well, I like, firstly, just to say, the idea of a person having extraordinary powers, because, you know, what the capitalist system does, and I'll come back to the movie in a bit.
Sure, go for it. Yeah, 100%.
What the capitalist system does is it really takes away our sense that we're each quite special, you know, that we have power, in other words, or powers. You can have the singular power. Power of the people and so on, but also powers, you know, the ability to run super fast or the ability to jump or fly or, you know, hit people and they collapse, you know. Maybe you have Muhammad Ali was a superpower guy, you know, he could clobber you or whatever, but really not because that's a sport. So there's something interesting about these films like Flash or Superman or Batman where, you know, let's leave Superman out because Superman is different. Superman comes from another planet.
Sure.
But where somebody discovers a power, you know, like Flash, just an ordinary kid sitting in a lab late at night, there's a storm and a flash of lightning strikes and there's chemicals in front of him and he gets struck with those chemicals and he gets a power, you know, an incredible power.
Right.
Move beyond the speed of light, really.
Mm.
Okay. So suddenly an ordinary kid has powers, you know, that's interesting. That's a fantasy of every jerk who has to survive in the capitalist system, you know.
Right.
It's like every jerk wants to have powers of some kind, you know. Look at what people do to their cars or what they do, you know, to their bodies. They tattoo themselves with emblems of superpowers, you know, lightning strikes. Mm. You got a car with a lightning or I can drive as far. No, you can't. You really can't because there's a speed limit and the cop will pull you over and harass you. And, you know, you might go to jail and so on. But I can do it. I have a power. I'm greater than that person who goes into an office and is mistreated. And here comes Superman because, you know, Clark Kent comes from Krypton. You know, Jael comes from Krypton, whatever. But he's a schmuck, man. He's insulted by everybody in the office.
Yeah.
You know, he's the guy that they're like, hey, Clark, you got your glasses on, you know.
He never gets the girl. Like, yeah.
Dweeb, you know, I guess in American culture, he'd be the dweeb character.
Yeah.
But really, he can go into the closet or the phone booth and he emerges as Superman.
Right.
There's something there that's attractive, I think, to ordinary people about the Marvel, you know, landscape is this ability of pretty regular folk to have something happen to you. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, you know, it's toxic slime that gives them the flotsam of capitalism in contradiction suddenly gives them power. You know, they become these incredible Ninja Turtles who can talk, you know, and do and have adventures and so on. So the Flash is like that. Now, the interesting ethical dilemma is he goes back in time. He can run so fast. He can beat the clock, you know, and he can turn time back. It's not actually a new idea because, you know, we had that already in the Superman films. Fly like that and you can turn back.
The very Lewis first one,
in the 70s,
right, to save Lois Lane and so on. Anyway, he goes back and he tries to change history. Now, we know, actually, very interesting, that there's a lot of literature, including Star Trek, which says don't get involved. Remember, the first ordinance of Star Trek is do not get involved. You know, you
can they always break it in those episodes. Exactly. They always do. Ordinance,
you know,
yeah,
that's and it's almost like an ordinance to society. Don't try to change history. It's what it is, guys. Mm-hmm. Don't get involved. Mm-hmm. But this kid tries, you know, and he messes things up, and he keeps having to go back, and he discovers himself. Even this is a spoiler. He's himself
been out for a while.
Has to stop himself because nobody else can, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I found it quite interesting because it tells you a lot about the philosophy of history, you know. Does one have the right to intervene? Okay, the three of us, I don't know about you, but I don't know how to change time. I don't know how to go back.
Haven't figured it out myself, no.
Still working on
that. It out. You know, the time machine, every kid in an industrial society had some box sitting somewhere their room, which they pretended was their either time machine or spacecraft, you know, which is basically the same thing.
No doubt. But
in a way, this does raise questions, you know, do I have the right to change history? Do ordinary people have the right to intervene, to organize, to build movements? It actually raises bigger questions than people who just dismiss these films, okay? Because when you walk out of the film, you're thinking, you know, was it okay for Flash to have gone back to try to protect his father and save his mother? You know, was that okay? Or was it not okay? Those are existential questions, you know. Is it okay to imagine that, you know, those of us who are basically the jerks of capitalism, getting jerked around, in other words, by the system, do we have the right to try to change things, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, man, I mean, I think that film, for me, that made me think more. I haven't seen the Oppenheimer movie. I'm going to see it.
Mm.
But I think that film made me think about things more than maybe even the Oppenheimer film, which kind of is a slam dunk for me. The guy was a jerk. The
atom
bomb was a fucking, you know, it's a weapon of mass destruction. But The Flash made me think, man, like, you know, if I had the ability to go back, what would I change?
Right.
Would it be something personal, you know, in my history? I have things in my own history that I'm not happy with, you know, things that happened to me or things I did. Or do I go back and do I like assassinate Hitler? You know, would that have changed anything? The one person killed, I don't know if it would have changed a lot, but could have changed something. Mm-hmm. What can I do? Go even further back, you know, beg Judas, don't betray this guy, Jesus, man. He's a hell of a speaker. Mm-hmm. Let him go out there and talk the socialist ideas.
I'll give you 40 pieces of silver.
You know, man, Judas, take it easy, dude. I mean, you really need to betray this guy. He's a good speaker, you know. Do I do that? I mean, I'm just saying that this idea of acting in history, whether in the past or in the present or even in the near future, do we have a right? And movies like that make you think that. And I hope people think and reflect on this and feel some confidence. Oh, shit, I have the right to act, you know?
Right.
Mm-hmm. I don't have to be a spectator in history.
Absolutely.
Well, you bring up Superman, kind of an example of that on the Marvel end is Spider-Man. You know, he's just a kid. He's just a working class kid, at least in his original incarnation. Right. He's bitten by a spider. He's got super strength. What's the first thing his uncle teaches him? With great power comes great responsibility. Right. So that's the thing. You know, if it's you're led to, it's kind of the blade itself inciting to deeds of one type or another, right? You know, you have this thing, you want to do something with it, right? But you have to have a guiding principle in life. You have to be willing to help clean up the mess, essentially. But what does that look like? What does that mean, right? And the way that the story unfolds, I think, leads to, you know, you're correct, something, you know, really interesting stuff in one direction or another.
Well, you know, I'm glad you brought up Spider-Man, because old Spidey is a classic example of exactly right. What I would say is a better example in a way even than Flash, because, they're actually similar. Flash is a lower middle class kid. Spidey was like a working class kid. It's very similar.
He's a journalist, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, something happens to you. It's imposed on you, this power. And then you have to think, how do I do it? Well, a lot of comics turn the superhero against the criminal. It's interesting. It's like the underworld, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, in Batman, it's a Penguin. It's a diabolical figure. You know, it's mm-hmm. the Saddam Hussein.
Yeah.
It's the Muammar Gaddafi. It's the Vladimir Putin. You know, it's this. That's where these comic books get super conservative, mm-hmm. because the enemy isn't, say, the capitalist system. Now there are contradictions, correct? Because even in Batman, there are contradictions. There is the system. Batman himself, again, another story of parents being killed, you know, and why, and what's the story? And you never really get it, you know. I mean, Christopher Nolan, and I mean, these people who make these films are interesting people, but they are also saturated in contradictions.
Oh, no doubt.
You know, they are not, it's not like these are quote unquote socialist films, but neither are they fully imperialist films. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm saying, is that they're saturated in contradictions, but mm-hmm. see how they smuggle in conservative ideas. Oh, it's the one bad guy. You know, if you get the Penguin, then you've saved humanity, you know, the Joker. Mm-hmm. Look how the parallel works in US foreign policy.
Sure.
There's always a Joker or a Penguin that they want to go after. You mm-hmm. know, Assad must go. Saddam must go. I mean, for God's sake, guys, the world is more complicated than XYZ must go. Mm. You know, that is why anarchist politics of like assassinating a person never really advances a project. Look at the United States. So many presidents have been assassinated. Okay.
Right.
It's actually quite surprising how many presidents have been assassinated, but mm-hmm. the structure remains intact.
Yes.
You know, and there's a trivial way in which this idea exists, you know. Get the Joker and everything's gone. Get, you know, doesn't work like that, man. The structure is far deeper, and you've got to build mass movements for structural transformation. Mm-hmm. That requires patience and so on. Very hard to make a film about that. I mean, I'm going to put it there that, you know, I've seen a lot of quote unquote socialist directors making films about class struggle and, you know, strikes. Matewan, for instance, amazing film by John Sayles. There's a ton of British directors who make working class films, but it's a hard film to make to show a revolution. You know, right. The painstaking, boring work of structural transformation. You know, you can look at a film like Reds, which was, I don't know if you've seen Reds, very inspiring movie made by Warren Beatty based on John Reed's book. But really, that movie is not about revolution. The revolution is the background. It's about a heroic character who's John Reed. It's about heroism. But look at what Warren Beatty does, which I found cool, is he starts the movie with veterans of the US communist movement talking about their memories of John Reed and their own work as American communists. It's a very moving opening. It still doesn't, as a plot, you know, doesn't show you how to change things fundamentally. So you end up, because of the two and a half hour length, you end up with this extremely interesting character, Flash, Spider-Man, and so on. But they can only confront the one bad individual.
Right.
Because it's too complicated to have Spidey take on capitalism.
It's interesting because we were talking about this not too long ago, that it is much easier for media to maybe have a criticism of the system than it is for it to present the creation of something new or how you could actually structurally transform. There's a lot of stuff that could be interpreted as broadly anti-capitalist or anti-greed, at least, or whatnot in these movies and books and TV. But then when it goes on to what's the next step, it very often is seen as, oh, that's too far, or that's just as bad, or whatever. You know, you have the example of, you know, we talked about Black Panther, like his radical enemy, his solution to imperialism is shown as just as bad, or even worse. Or you see something like the Hunger Games, where the people who are revolting, it's like, well, they use violence, so they're just as bad as the oppressors. And so that's a subtle way that, you know, even this sort of anti-capitalist or anti-imperialist, if it even is that, fiction can have these more subtle narratives. And I don't think it's always this intentional plot or anything by the creators. I think they're just so steeped in a capitalist society that that happens. Not to say that there haven't been State Department plots to put things in movies and stuff, because there certainly has as well. But what are your thoughts on that? Like the idea of selling someone anti-capitalism without exactly bringing them to the revolution, to a transformation.
Yeah, man. I mean, firstly, let's just acknowledge it's really hard to make a film. I don't mean
financing
and all of that. You know, I don't mean any of that. I just mean, it's really hard to even write a screenplay. I think often of Boots Riley. And Boots made a really super anti-capitalist film, you know. Sorry to bother you. It's incredible. It has a weird ending. Why? Because suddenly there are horse people and so on. And but, you know, it's a really profound movie about people who work in call centers and you know, they're just the degradation of capitalism. But then the capitalist in it is a pretty pathetic character, you know. And in the end, this movie sort of fizzles out for me. You know, I thought it was a terrific film, and I sympathize with Boots, because how do you end a movie like that? Well, let's create a horse man in the basement. Sure. And that's so weird. People will be like, what the hell? But then how do you end the movie? You know, the only way to end the movie is to get your own against the guy who owns that one shop. Mm-hmm. You know, that's really the limit of how we learn to portray, you know, capitalism. I don't see anything beyond that. Go back to an earlier film, one of the great union films of all time, Salt of the Earth, which is one of the only movies banned in the United States, made in the middle of an actual miners' strike in the southwest of the U.S., where the actors in the movie were families of the miners. You know, it's a great film. But in the end of the movie, it has to end, you know, either with the victory or the defeat of the miners. You know, there's no way to pull the lens back and say we're talking about capitalism and socialism. We're talking about this struggle, Meitwan, over here. It gets defeated. It wins. It gives you a sense of the power of participation and so on. And to my mind, that's fine. That's enough. You see, what can art do? Socialist art, what can it do? What should it do? In our time, it's my view that socialist art has to cut through the sense of alienation and isolation people have, that feeling. And here's the ironic thing, is while I love superhero movies kind of reinforce the isolation and the atomization. Because end of the day, you know, it's not like the people are acting. It's like Spidey saves the day, or, you know, or Batman or Superman or whoever, and that Zionist, you know, Wonder Woman saves the day, whatever.
Yeah.
It's always the individual who saves the day, you know, the hero. So, I mean, I love those films and they excite me and so on. And they're exciting partly because of this idea that even we ordinary schmucks can develop a superpower. But why can't our superpower be the power of organizing? The power, you know, why can't, you know, okay, some years ago, a friend of mine gave me a fantastic comic book, which is that Superman, or Jarel, before he becomes Superman, his pod lands in the USSR. Okay. Doesn't land in Ohio or wherever the hell it lands. It lands somewhere in the middle of the USSR. And Red this Sun. Guy becomes a communist Superman with a big hammer and sickle and whatever. It's a pretty funny comic. It's actually I think a Marvel spin-off comic. It's not some radical, mm-hmm. but it's pretty funny because it's a premise, right?
Yeah.
The Earth is spinning and the pod ends up, you know, 20 minutes later than it did enter Earth's mm-hmm. atmosphere, and then it goes to the USSR. It doesn't have to be hours later because it takes time. Anyway.
Oh, yeah.
So there it is. But even there, it then became a Cold War comic, you know, about Superman versus the superheroes of the West. It's a Cold War comic. I think it's really hard to produce art in our social situation that reveals something of socialism. It's really hard. Mm-hmm. It's not easy. I think it's easier to produce anti-capitalist art, particularly nowadays, when the confidence in socialism is so low and the social imagination to grasp socialism so low. It's much easier to do anti-capitalist art. So I don't have such a harsh criticism of, you know, friendly filmmakers and so on. I think they're doing the best they can in this context. Now, we should still keep discussing and thinking, well, how do we make a better story? Like, what's a way to tell the story of socialism that's going to inspire people to get organized? You know, what's the best way? In a way, and I once met the guys who made the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
That
premise could have gone in a socialist direction. Because remember, it's not one guy.
It's
a team, you know, and maybe they could get other people into their team. They don't, though, you know. It just stops at, what is it, the four of them or five of them. Why can't they go out there and get more people into their team, bring them into the sewers, train them, you know. They don't have to have superpowers. They can train not only turtles, but other animals and so on, and then lead a rebellion. Could be interesting. But again, it sounds dumb when I say it, you know. And that's because our horizon is narrowed. That it sounds dumb and predictable. And, you know, one last thing I'll tell you. There was a terrific Hindi movie from the 70s, I think, called Garam Hawa, which means the warm wind. Mm. The movie is about a Muslim family in India deciding not to go. Well, some of the family members go to Pakistan, some stay in India. In the last scene, this guy who decides not to go to Pakistan gets off a horse cart. He's in the city. Leaves his home and he walks down the road and then he turns the corner and he runs into a massive communist demonstration. And the last scene of the movie, he just walks into that demonstration and the movie follows the march, and then the movie ends. That's a beautiful, beautiful ending, because he just enters into that kind of line of history, as it were. But it's like a Deus Ex Machina, you know. It's like a spacecraft that comes from somewhere and just takes you off, you know. It's unexpected. It's not in the narrative flow of the film. But I just don't know how to... As I say, we are blocked. History is not allowing us to produce this new, genuinely socialist art that is not merely anti-capitalist.
It's difficult to go back, and that's what I think we should drill down and do in the near future of the pod, is try and go back and drill down into, because there does exist American proletarian fiction, I'm struggling to think of a genuine media story, property, material of that stripe in today, right? Because today it's all about, as you say, the superhero. It's all about the protagonist. You know, who are we following? You know, whose desires are we, you know, you can have one struggle or another that's the backdrop of that, right? But I'm genuinely struggling to come up with a really populist oriented. Are you familiar with the film Black Klansman?
No, you know, I was thinking of going to see it, but then something happened. I was traveling, and by the time I came back, it had gone. And I love seeing films in film theaters, frankly.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
I hate watching it on my computer. I mean, I do it.
Mm-hmm. It's not the same, though.
It's not you really films like that. So I'm sorry I didn't see that. Yeah.
Yeah.
But tell me about it.
Yeah. I mean, you really got to, you know, some films are big screen movies, some are not. I mean, this you can make the argument, but it's about, it's in the 70s, I believe. It's based on a true story about a Black man who was the first Black police officer in Colorado Springs. And he does this sort of sting operation, infiltrating the KKK over the phone and pretending to be a white man, basically, and busting a big old like a white supremacist ring in the area. It's a really interesting movie. I like it a lot. It makes up for Spike Lee's remake of Old Boy, TBH. It's weird because what you said about films that can be that can have a critique of the existing system, right, without necessarily articulating an alternative, sort of twig that in my mind, because, you know, it has a lot of really intelligent things to say about how reactionaries sort of build their movement outside the sort of mass base of things and you know, pull off infiltrations and whatnot. But it doesn't really prescribe a mass base like alternative to that. Like ultimately the heroes are, you know, the one good cop that sort of rallies people and pulls off a purge. Right. So it does kind of fall down on that front, especially in the context of, you know, the policing discourse in this country today, you know, so it's a limitation that you sort of go in there unable to kind of shake.
Hmm.
Yeah, I mean, you know, let's not get into cop films because those are super interesting on their own. I mean, it's interesting that so many cop films are buddy films one way or the other, you know, and I don't mean like Die Hard. I also mean other cop films where it's an ensemble cast. They're all kind of pals and so on. You know, they're all, it's very interesting because somebody could do an analysis of the unities between the cop films and the mafia films, you know, or even the Sopranos, because there's always like these kind of Italian or Irish buddies, you know, who are on the force. And there's something interesting about Italian and Irish working class representation, how these communities are represented. It's either the cop film or it's the, you know, the sometimes the union film. I mean, if you go back and watch Wall Street, that's an interesting film because look, a film is about producing for the viewer an ethical dilemma, in my opinion. Fiction in general should awaken in you an ethical dilemma. And the film Wall Street, which is, I think, completely misremembered, because the way people remember it is, you know, Gordon Gekko, the capitalist, you know, greed is good and so on. But in fact, the heart of the film is about a father and son. It's about a father who's a union leader at an airport for an airline, and the son who's working for Gordon Gekko, and Gekko hires the boy knowing that this is the son of the union leader, and he wants the union to back down so he can make a deal. So now the son, okay, has an ethical dilemma. Do I, for the sake of my own advancement, screw my dad and people I grew up with? You know, I mean, that's the neoliberal dilemma. And that's what the film is really about. The film doesn't celebrate greed. The film is an ethnography of a dilemma, you know, a dilemma that young working class people in many countries face. Do I betray my community for my personal gain, you know, or do I stand with my community? That is a tremendous socialist film. It's very interesting. It's not remembered like that. You know, it's remembered as a kind of salutation to Wall Street. In fact, in my opinion, Wall Street is a sideshow in the film. The real dilemma is at the airport. And it's between Martin Sheen and his son. You know, he's played in the movie by his son. And I think that's a great socialist film because it raises the fundamental ethical dilemma. And those who haven't seen Oliver Stone's Wall Street, I highly recommend it because you think you've seen that movie, but watch it again because you haven't. You know, most likely you've just seen clips of Gordon Gekko saying greed is good, you know, but you haven't watched the movie. When you watch the movie, you recognize this is a class war within the class, you know, where certain people in the class who are perhaps bright or get some advantages or whatever are able to, quote unquote, have an exit from the class. And at that moment of exit, it's a Faustian bargain. The devil has come to Faust and says, give me your soul and I'll give you immortality. And in a way, Gordon Gekko is the devil coming to this young boy and saying, give me your father's head on a plate and I'll give you a multi-million dollar job, you know, forever. And that's a dilemma. You're going to kill your father for the riches of the world? Are you going to sell your soul to get immortality? You're going to live the rest of your life without a soul? You know, I have a lot of friends that went into the world of finance in the 1980s. It is a soul-crushing profession, okay? Right. Your soul is emptied. So the whole Dr. Faust, written long before Finance Capital is dominant, was actually quite a visionary text, provides the fundamental ethical dilemma for people under conditions of capitalism. You know, do you, not for the sake of survival, but for the sake of aggrandizement, do you cut a deal with the devil? You know, My aunt used to ask me when I got involved in the left movement, she would say, son, what's your price? At what price will you sell out to the devil? You know, what price? And socialists need to ask themselves their price, but it's not about socialists. It's a civilizational and cultural issue. Mm. What's the culture teaching us? You know, across countries like the United States, Canada, Great Britain, France, Germany, these old industrialized countries, the richer countries, it's a question to ask, you know, is it worth selling out your class for your personal aggrandizement? And having sold out your class, how do you live with yourself? You know, how do you live with yourself? Well, the film Wall Street really picks it up. But again, so do a lot of these, you know, lesser films. I say lesser by which I mean they are more kind of pulp films. The Marvel type films and so on. They also raise in a different way this fundamental ethical question of what is your, how do you want to live in the world, you know?
Absolutely. I have you heard of the book? We talked about it on the show some months ago, but there is a book and it's truly terrible, as you might imagine. It's a novel written by Bill Clinton. Have you heard of it? The President Is Missing? It's quite bad, as you might expect.
Okay. Firstly, I would like to just say for the record, that George W. Bush has become a painter of art, including a portrait of himself naked in the bathtub.
It's depraved. I don't know
if you've seen that particular awful piece of fine art.
Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, I have.
I believe Hillary Clinton has written a mystery novel.
And now, yes, so has Bill Clinton.
Mm-hmm. I'm told. And it comes, therefore, as no surprise to me that Big Bill, in his time of retirement, has written a piece of crap. He was a piece of crap president.
Oh yeah.
And so surprised that he's written a piece of crap book. But
yeah, the
tell
reason
me about this book, because I am never completed.
You shouldn't. We only read it so we could talk about it, and even then it was quite a skim. But it comes at this question you're talking about from a direction that, you know, I would say a normal person would never think, which is it's the story of this president who got where he is from nothing. And this president in the novel, which is very much a self-insert character for Bill, because he's still a deeply insecure man, despite having all his accomplishments. It basically takes the stance that you should do everything. You should sell everyone out. This guy has sacrificed everything, is willing, and it presents it as a greater good. And I thought it was, while I would never recommend anyone reading it, it was such an interesting look into the mind of like the capitalist class and the political elite class, this idea of, no, anyone can make it. You just have to be willing to sell your soul. And so when we see films like Wall Street or another film similar to that, Wolf of Wall Street, a film that shows all this degradation, shows how miserable these people are. A movie like maybe American Psycho comes to mind as well. Someone shows how fundamentally miserable the people at the top are, how soulless, how unimportant. Mm-hmm. It actually comes at it from the direction of, this is good. And it's really depraved and terrible. But I was just thinking on it while you were talking about that, because it's just this story of this guy who rises to the top and then, you know, he's the hero. He saves the country from a terrorist operation. The president himself fights off the attackers. He was also a Major League Baseball player and all the women like him. It's very embarrassing. It would not have been published if he was not independently famous. Deeply embarrassing book. But it is interesting to see that the sort of the psychology at the heart of the capitalist class, you know,
and it's nuts because, right, it's not written ironically at all. It's written completely straight, you know.
I'd have written it as a joke, like a satire.
right. But, you know, its target is, you know, Clinton's fanboys, right? The Clintonite sort of liberals of this country who, you know, there's a scene toward the end where, you know, the American president and the Israeli prime minister and the German chancellor are all kind of getting together at the president's billionaire friend's like a compound in West Virginia to figure out how to solve the problem. And I'm reading this like, for a certain type of person, this is like the Avengers.
Right. But yeah.
It's and it's crazy to me that, but what you said interested me about genuinely intelligent, you know, perhaps even genuinely socialist media that raises those interesting questions, right? But might get misconstrued, right? I'm thinking, I mean, American Psycho is another great example. I'm thinking Fight Club, you know, these people who, for a certain type of person, you know, you look at them and they're like, yeah, you know, they go in, you know, you're Tyler Durden's and you're Patrick Bateman's, right? You know, they do what they want. They mess stuff up. And they sort of don't see past that surface, in that disruptive surface, right? And what do you do with people who look at Starship Troopers and think, yeah, you know, military is really cool, and kind of look past that message of, well, why are we sending a generation into a meat grinder, right? It's that sort of discursive environment where this stuff gets completely turned on its head, right? You know, I'm not saying, you know, the CIA bankrolled the spread of 1984, the publication of that, for example. You know, I'm not saying that happens all the time, but, you know, it's these very convenient narratives that spring up around otherwise really interesting media, even if the media themselves aren't necessarily revolutionary.
Well, the first thing is that, of course, no artist can control how their message is taken.
Without a doubt, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay. I don't know, this may have just been something you missed, but if you watched the US version of House of Cards, which is in a way a kind of composite character of every liberal president from Clinton onward, you know, it's really a kind of Clinton, actually, you know,
sure.
A Southern guy killed somebody, you know, there's a kind of Clinton sleaze there.
Yeah.
But I wonder how many, if you ask people who's your favorite character in House of Cards, the US version, how many people would pick, you know, the president? I think a lot of people would pick the president, or maybe his wife, you know, who's equally diabolical, you know, and so on. Why would they pick them? You know, why? In a way, because they're successful. And there's a success bias in a capitalist society. That's just the nature of things. That's why, you know, these superhero films are interesting, because it's like Spider-Man, working class kid bitten by a spider, but then the success bias works in his favor, you know, that the guy can do all these amazing things. You want to be like him. You don't want to be, you know, like the people who are standing outside the gates of the White House in the House of Cards show protesting. I mean, those people look like idiots.
Right.
You know, I mean,
they look unimportant. You know? Yeah.
Yeah. They're going to do that. Then they're going to go back to their houses. They're going to eat some miserable meal, and they don't even allow themselves to smoke at the window and look so cool, you know, and so on, you know. So there's a success bias in a capitalist society when it comes to fiction, nonfiction. When you look at the British version of House of Cards, it was only 3 episodes, super different.
Interesting.
Very interesting. The prime minister does all those things, you know, he seduces a young journalist, has to kill her. I mean, the first season of the US one is a complete ripoff of the British House of Cards, only 3 episodes. But the British House of Cards has an underlying thing, which is that these people are nasty. Mm-hmm. You know, there's an underlying, because British society has a much more class conscious attitude. You know, this elite is nasty. This is the Thatcherite elite. Fuck them, you know. So that was more hard-boiled, you know, anti-Thatcherite kind of feeling. Now, you can watch the movie and actually sympathize with the prime minister, just to tell you that there is not this direct, you can't control this. On the other hand, from my perspective, more interesting than what the, you know, okay, when you go to see a movie, right? Most people, I don't know if everybody, you go see a movie with a few of your friends, right? What's the best part of the movie? It's not the movie, man. It's when you go to the bar or get an ice cream or whatever, and the 4 of you are sitting around a table arguing about the film, right?
Yeah.
That is the best political education, you know?
Sure.
That's a real political school right there, you know? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I personally, and you get a lot of intellectual stimulation. I mean, it's funny. You sometimes wish that high school literature classes would be like that, you know, bar room atmosphere after a film.
Sure.
You know, where everybody's chatting and there's nobody there who's telling you you're wrong. You know, a lot of high school education is the teachers like, that's a wrong interpretation. You know, whereas when you're in the bar with your friends, people just gang up on each other saying, that's bullshit. You're so different yeah. from saying from a position of authority. That's wrong. You know, mm-hmm. when I was in school, I was in a literature group, you know, a bunch of friends. We'd read books. We'd argue. I loved that. It made me love reading, you know, in fact. So, in fact, yeah, man, the film can't dictate anything. It's the after film conversations and discussions. And I often feel that, you know, like we judge a movie, you know, I walk out of, let's say, I don't know, oh, man, I went to see that great film about the one solitary Scandinavian guy who kills all the Nazis. It was an amazing film. I've forgotten the name. It's some Norwegian or Finnish movie with one word, whatever. Super good film, you know. Like this guy, they hang him and he finds a nail underneath his foot on the post and he stands on the nail.
Oh, wow.
I mean, the guy never, it's like John Wick, okay? Another mm-hmm. film series I love. I watched John Wick 1, 2, 3, 4. It's the same movie. Mm-hmm. Each of the movies of John Wick is the same. But John Wick is amazing. You know, you want to be him. You want to be that guy who takes on all the villains of the world, you know, with what? With like, not, he doesn't even have guns. He
doesn't need them.
He doesn't need them.
He finds a stapler to throw at him or something.
Fourth floor hotel window and he just gets up and walks. I mean, John Wick, man, you don't even need to be bitten by a spider. You're just awesome. You know, you're amazing. So what I'm trying to say is that, you know, these films, you know, this film, this Nazi solitary guy who goes and blows everybody up, John Wick, whatever, they create a lot of excitement in you and you're dying to talk about the film to your friends. And we underestimate the power of that democratization of art, you know, where the viewers argue with each other. You know what I would do? I wouldn't spend, if I had a lot of money, I wouldn't spend the money making a film right now. But I would design a new kind of film theater, you know, where the point wasn't that you buy popcorn and soda and go and take it in and watch it in the film and then go home. But you come in, you watch the film, and then there's a bar right there or something, you know, some way to capture you so you're arguing and discussing. And people can't say, I'm tired, I'm going home. You know, you go to see a movie with a friend and they're like, I'm tired, I'm going home. No, man, the movie starts now.
Mm-hmm.
When the lights go on in the theater, that's when the movie starts, man. Don't say, I'm tired, I want to go home. That's when you've got to sit down with a bunch of friends and that's the political education about culture, you know? And that's why I don't like watching movies often on my thing. I like to go to the movie theater, you know, like to feel the vibe of other people and so on. It democratizes art, you know, conversation democratizes art.
Even a fundamentally like less than interesting or not that good, quote unquote, movie can be a lot more enjoyable when you experience it with someone, you know, or doesn't have to be a movie, can be any piece of art because it's a social experience and we're social animals. And that's a great thing. And that's a thing that, you know, capitalism often takes from us. And I think it also turns these avenues of conversation. It tries to push them into spaces like online and things like that. And that's not always necessarily bad, but it can become toxic in a way that face-to-face conversations show so rarely is, in my experience, for sure. But like even like I saw Barbie the other day. It was a really goofy movie. Me and my friends dressed up as the different Barbies and Kens to go see it. We had a lot of fun. Got talking with someone in the theater afterwards, and we just like went back and forth on it. And that's an interesting movie because it has some like criticisms of, you know, patriarchy and stuff in it. But then at the end of the day, it kind of exists to sell products for the Mattel Corporation. So that's another movie that's full of contradictions. But, you know, in that moment, it's not about the Mattel Corporation. It's about the guy next to you who's wearing a funny costume and you're wearing a funny costume and you talk and say, I liked this, I didn't like this. That would be interesting. Absolutely. And that's
well, wait a minute. That movie is also Ryan Gosling. So
that's true.
Know, Ryan Gosling is amazing. So
he is good. He's quite good.
Whatever, you know. He's good in all the movies. I mean, the thing is, there are some actors that I just think are amazing, whether they act or not. Okay.
Sure.
I think he's just.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen it yet. I mean.
He has a dance number in it. It's very funny. He's very funny in it.
I could go and see it. I'm in Santiago. I could go see it, but it would be in Spanish. And I don't know. I wonder what the Barbie movie would be like in Spanish. That's a very. Different. By itself, an ethnographic experience.
No doubt. No doubt.
Cillian Murphy is another actor like that. Who, I mean, he's an Oppenheimer, right? But he's also in
In Batman.
Yeah, in Batman. He's in.
So was Margot Robbie. If you think about it, both Batman villains, and they're both in the big movie. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
The crossover, yeah.
To think of it.
He's in a really good movie called The Wind That Shakes the Barley that I watched back in, 100%. It's about Irish Civil War and how, you know, it's not over just, the fight isn't over just because the revolution has succeeded or partially succeeded, depending on where you fall on that, right? Mm-hmm.
It's such a good movie. Also, the name of the movie is so good.
Yes.
The Wind That Shakes the Barley. Because what? Why? You know, what is it saying to us? That, you know, you organize against the system, you want to change the wretchedness of the system and all that. And then this wind starts to blow, you know. Yeah. And I always say, you know, that's Lenin's What Is to Be Done. Mm. You build the barley, you know, you build the stalk, you build the organizations, but you have to prepare for the wind, you know.
The objective condition, yes. For.
You keep doing struggles to bring more and more people and so on. And then the wind comes, the wind that shakes the barley. That's a revolution, man. Mm-hmm. That's what, you know, you know, it's also shouldn't be misunderstood that the barley evokes the wind. You know, you build the barley, you call the wind, you know.
Yeah. Trees, when you plant trees, it pulls in rain. For a long time, people didn't realize that. In fact, I read a great article about how natives, when Europeans came over, said the trees call the rain, and they called them savages and called them backwards. Turns out about 150 years later, they learned the trees do call the rain. And that's exactly right there. The building, the growing is calling the conditions as well, which is why organizing is so important. I mean, Joss and I both organize on a daily or do organizing work on a daily basis. And I get asked, hey, this isn't the revolution. You're working to get rent control. You're working to whatever. And it's like, yeah, but we're teaching people how to fight, and we're teaching ourselves how to fight, because I've got a hell of a lot to learn. We all do. Mm-hmm. So that's like a great point. I'm glad you bring that up. I didn't even make that connection with the movie. I need to rewatch it, honestly.
No, it's an amazing movie. But by the way, again, I just want to repeat, it's basically Lenin 1903, you know, What Is to Be Done.
Yeah.
And I very much appreciate what you said about the trees bringing the rain, because it is that dialectic, you know. On the one side, you know, we work to build the forest, you know, and then we wait for the rain to come. But also the building the forest is calling the rain. And the combination of the forest and the rain, in a way, is the revolutionary moment, or when the wind shakes the barley. That's the revolutionary moment. And why do we have leadership that needs experience and so on? Is you also have to be able to detect, is this the right moment? You know, I mean, or are we misreading the moment? I mean, that's a, you know, in the middle of the Russian Revolution, Lenin wrote a beautiful little piece that's little read called Insurrection is an Art. You know, he said, it's not a science, it's an art to know when to act. It's an art form, it's not a science. Well, what is the difference between science and art? Science is something that, where reality can be calibrated, you can measure it, you know that it's repeatable and so on. An art or a moment of artistry is not calibratable, repeatable and so on. It requires, you know, judgment. Judgment is something you shape through experience. It's a pretty interesting way to understand, you know, those ideas, whether you can bring those ideas into art or not, you know, whether it's possible. I have great sympathy for art precisely because it's not repeatable. You know, even people say, well, you know, those films are formula films, Marvel films. I don't agree. You know, all stories have a formula. You know, there's a tragedy, and then there's struggle, and then there's either recuperation or further tragedy. You know, there's always a kind of cliche, or rather, there's always a set piece. You know, you can't have a movie that's completely original. It's not possible. Humans tell, you know, 8-9 different varieties of stories. The question isn't that. It's the magic inside it. You know, it's not that, oh, you can just repeat the same formula. In India, they say, they sometimes people disparagingly call Indian cinema formula films. I think that's very unfair. You know, because those films are not all, there's some formulaic things, you know, that are there. As I said, all the John Wick films are the same. In every film, he has to fight somebody in a gallery of mirrors. That's imperative. Well, that's also because it's really cool filmmaking.
Yeah, it's fun to watch.
The mirrors and the gun, the bullets and the Japanese fighting weapons and so on. And Keanu Reeves, man, the guy, you know, completely, he's found his métier, you know, from when you say from Speed, where he was great, but, you know, he was like a robot almost. But then with the Matrix films and then with John Wick, he's discovered his métier, which is flat, you know, almost perspectiveless character. And he's amazing at it. Well, but that's that's what he's really good at. He's always been that guy. Well, I don't, you know, that's who he is. And he's great at it. And those are true. But it's not a formula because each of them has a certain spark. And there's a different kind of intensity that comes in, and that's judgment, you know, that requires what Kant calls judgment. A very important part of the analysis of art and so on is the world of judgment. And judgment isn't what the viewer brings to the movie. Judgment is also happening inside the film, you know, or in the novel or whatever. There are moments of declaration, ethical dilemmas, you know, closures, opening, false closures, where people falsely solve dilemmas. You know, you say, hey, listen, that's not a solution. The television show Succession, for instance, one false closure of ethical dilemmas after the other. Right. And that's a really interesting show because you oscillate between support of Shiv, Logan, Kendall. I hate them all.
Sure.
Then again, Shiv, Logan, Kendall. I hate them all. I can't believe I'm sucked into this. I don't give a shit about these big corporations. Where are the workers? No, but I'm with Kendall. I mean, these are all false closures of ethical dilemmas. And, you know, that's judgment.
I feel the same way about, have you seen Righteous Gemstones before?
No.
It's a show about a mega church family. It's a similar kind of thing where they're competing for power. And it's, you know, very much a criticism of, you know, capitalist evangelicalism. But you do actually get engaged in the story. It's like, wait, is the Walton Goggins character gonna come out with his Bible game show? Is he gonna win? Or is it, and it's all cynical on its face, but it's you know, it's a lot of, you know, interesting to watch it play out. But absolutely. Okay, well, I really, you know, I appreciate that perspective you're bringing to that. That's like a lot of, you know, a lot of interesting things to think about. One thing I will note is that talking about that creativity, even in films that we consider more or less formulaic, like even if we consider them, you know, stock films, quote unquote, like Marvel films, there is still a lot of human elements in that, which is part of the reason we got to support these strikes that are going on for the writers, for the actors, and all labor action on that to sort of fight against, you know, encroaching artificial intelligence on these jobs. Obviously, greed, the more greed, the more the producers get their hands in things, the less creativity is going to be able to come to the fore. So if you like good movies, you like good books, you like good games, whatever your preferred media choice is, you should want more creativity and less capitalism in those things. I think that that is pretty intuitive, but it's still a thing that, you know, bears repeating, because I think capitalists often see these as just a way of making money, whereas this is a, this art is a thing as old as humanity itself, really. I mean, way back to cave paintings and all that, you know?
Yeah, and that, and it can't, it can't be automated. You know, AI doesn't have comedic timing. AI doesn't have, you know, personal, you know, history, trauma, experience to draw from. You know, it has what other people have created, and it regurgitates that, right? You know, it can, you know, I mean, broken clocks, you know, it can hit certain, it can hit certain notes, you know, but it, it doesn't have, there's no genuine element. There is no struggle that birthed it. You know, it is just a con, you know, a construct entire.
No, no, I'm really happy you mentioned that because, you know, this is a global issue. This idea of, you know, what happened in the last maybe 35 odd years is copyright has become such an important battlefield of essentially appropriation of intellectual labor of workers to companies. And now companies hold copyright. I'll give you an example. The other day, I saw an academic book which online, which was for sale for, I think, $750. $750, one book, 57,000 rupees for those who are interested, $750. And I was thinking, how much did the writers get? Because these are all professors. They probably work for free.
Yeah.
That is to say, their college salaries cover the research and the writing and all of that. Mm-hmm. And because the book is so expensive, it's going to be go to libraries and whatever. And if there are royalties, they're not going to come to the writers. Unlikely. Very small royalty. So this appropriation of intellectual labor and then intellectual property contested deeply by the company is something that has really turned the tide. You know, I understand when musicians say, we're getting off Netflix, you know, because, oh, not Netflix,
Spotify.
Spotify, because, you know, we don't get a good deal. I very much am with them. But I also think it's kind of tragic because, see, what happens? Spotify is a monopoly, basically, okay? I listen basically to, when I'm on the road, I'm a Spotify guy.
Yeah.
I can't say anything else to you because where the hell else am I going to go to, like MySpace, or where am I going to listen to music?
Yeah,
downloaded exactly. Pirate sites, you know, it just takes too much effort. Okay,
cassette frankly. Tape, no, not happening.
Yeah, I'm too old to be spending hours downloading, you know, from some pirated, I don't know, websites, whatever. I'm not doing that. I'm going to just go to Spotify.
Right.
Wait. So the problem here isn't that Neil Young says, I'm out of Spotify. The problem is that Spotify is a monopoly. And why can't, for instance, why can't we have Spotify be like a public utility? You know, why can't the United Nations own Spotify? And they, you know, they basically transfer profits to the performers and, you know, don't make a profit. Have it be a not-for-profit international music streaming system. Netflix. Why doesn't the United Nations take over Netflix and Spotify?
Put them all together, HBO, lump them all in.
All of them. All the streaming services. Make my life a lot easier, frankly.
Absolutely.
Because, you know, I watch HBO Max, okay? I feel guilty a little bit, you know, saying, well, I had to buy a subscription. But what choices do we have? You know, people say, well, why don't you watch on YouTube? Even there, you have to buy films. It's not free. You want to watch a film?
That goes to Google.
Subscription, or you have to rent the movie. It's not free. Again, you can go to some website somewhere with a VPN and watch whatever. But man, I don't have the time. B, if I'm going down in some jurisdiction from some police or whatever, I don't want to be the guy who goes down for downloading films, okay? I would like to go down for being a Marxist, not for like Al Capone taken down for...
I was just thinking.
That's not happening with me, okay? Let's get him because he doesn't pay Spotify. He VPNs, tunnels into it. That's not going to happen.
So, video games. But
we don't have a public discourse. And I sound idiotic saying it because we don't have a public discourse about, you know, basically, why can't we socialize, you know, these streaming services, bring them under United Nations or some bloody, you know, international agency. You know, in the 1980, in fact, the McBride Report, which is a report on international communications, suggested that the satellites for communications be effectively a public utility.
Yeah.
Very interesting idea. Today, Elon Musk has four times the number of satellites than the government of China. You know, you talk about China's taking over the world. No, sorry. Mm-hmm. Young Elon is taking over the world, okay? He's going to dominate internet connectivity on the African continent through his Star satellite network.
Yeah,
you know?
Starlink.
And then, it's scary, man.
No doubt.
But there's no room in the public debate when we talk about art and so on to talk about socializing the means of distribution.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's no conversation. Now, means of production, that's a different thing. I'm just talking about the means of distribution. Like, for God's sake, can't we get Spotify without guilt?
Yeah, I mean, the public square these days, you know, is Twitter or X or whatever the hell it's called now. You know,
oh my God, it's another Elon Musk.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, exactly. He's fucking everywhere. Yeah. But that's the thing, you know, it's this creeping, you know, you bring up a very good point. It's this creeping enclosure of the commons, right? There's fewer public spaces, you know, in the real world. There's more and more barriers going up to, you know, there's a billion streaming services that everything is fractured into, right? And what do you do if you're not, you know, if you're not willing or if you're not able to pay for one or the other? Video games as well have a big problem with this, you know, institutional memory. Like, like if you want to play something that's from a previous console generation, you know, good luck tracking down something that runs it, let alone the game itself, right?
Mm-hmm. And you'll get, yeah. Actually, I was reading a story about a guy who downloaded a game that Nintendo no longer sells, and they sued him, even though they don't even sell it anymore. They said, no, we just don't want anyone to play it because we own it. And that's a kind of a silly example, but it's a sort of an example of how this intellectual property sort of thing works. And again, you're not seeing the people who made it back whenever getting paid for that or anything like that. No one's getting paid. No one's even using it. It's very interesting. Or like you read, Martin Scorsese now has a project to try and restore old films. You see how many films just sit in vaults and they're not even available, even on these massive streaming networks, because they don't see them as profitable. And that is, you know, antithetical to art, and it's antithetical to the idea of art for just about as long as we've been around until this very recently.
Yeah, a human experience older than recorded history, even older than Homo sapiens sapiens, you know, our species, right? It's, you know, what is it now? It's siloed off. It's appropriated. It's you know, a price has been put on something priceless, right? And what do we do with that?
Absolutely.
Well, guys, you know, super interesting to talk art and culture with you, because it's a big break for me. I'm talking, you know, economics and all the other things that have to be talked about. I would prefer to spend my whole day talking, pretending as if we just walked out of a movie theater.
Yeah.
And we're three friends just chatting about the movie we just watched. So I think we should do this again someday.
Absolutely.
Sit down and maybe the three of us should plan ahead and watch the same movie.
That would be great.
And then, that would be fantastic.
Right? And then sit down with in our different places where we are with a bowl of popcorn and a strong, you know, bourbon and whatever, Coke, and we can talk movies.
I would love 100%, to do that.
Yes.
I would love to do that. Before you go, Vijay, could you tell our, audience what anything you'd like to plug, anything I know a lot of them probably already have read your work, but if there's anything you want to plug, now would be a great time to do that.
Well, I would just say that they could go to thetricontinental.org, the website, and do two things. One is we have a statement about the new McCarthyism. And I very much would like people, if they can, to sign on to it, if they agree that there's a new McCarthyism and we need to fight it. And also subscribe to our materials. You'll get an email at least once a week from us, but not much more. On the one hand, fight for our right to exist. On the other, use our stuff.
Yeah. Absolutely. I would just say I do that myself. I just signed the statement. I do subscribe to Tricontinental. I have not regretted it. You've also got some great works. Just read Washington Bullets. Great book. There's quite a few. So yeah, y'all look into that. And we really appreciate you coming on. And would love to do it again sometime.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Great.
All right. The Socialist Shelf signing off.